soon we're gonna have a fever. We can't keep doing what we've been doing so long, but we can turn it around.
Green greetings. Welcome to the show, The Green Front. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg, joined by my favorite co-host, D.R. Tucker. And we're going to be talking today about our favorite topic, that is climate change. I hope you don't think we're overdoing it. We just don't think enough can be said about it. And since mainstream media is still MIA, missing in action in terms of regular coverage of the biggest challenge of our times, we think we should maybe go a little bit overboard. Going to have two fascinating guests today. We're going to be speaking in the first half about how mitigation and adaptation is not going to be enough. In the second half, we'll be speaking to someone who says it's going to really be all about resilience, how we're really going to have to swallow a bitter pill if we are to really take in what we're up against environmentally, but how that is really the most mentally healthy thing we can do. And probably our first guest will agree with that as well, because he's saying mitigation measures that the government is putting forth are just not nearly enough. So it's going to be a fascinating show. Welcome to The Green Front, D.R. Tucker and Howard Lattin.
Yes, how are you doing?
Great. Do we have you, Professor Lattin?
Yes, I'm here.
Wonderful. You are an environmental scholar, a distinguished professor at Rutgers University, and the author of a new book entitled Climate Change Policy Failures, Why Conventional Mitigation Approaches Cannot Succeed. Very provocative, very intriguing. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, but I have to say I don't agree with the notion that we just have to take the bitter pill and suck it up. I don't agree with that at all. There are things we can do. The problem is our political system isn't doing them.
Well, we'll talk about that, and we will have Reverend Earl Cotine on in the second half to perhaps explain that. I don't think he's saying we should just swallow it and sit back. He's saying we should first accept the reality of what we're up against and get out of denial, and then we can really start getting into action. So perhaps there's not as much disagreement. But disagreement's fine. That's okay, too. We'll see as the conversation goes forward. But what prompted you to write this book, and what in your background sort of qualifies you? I'm not saying this in any kind of challenging way, just intrigued that someone with a law background, environmental law, would really take the subject on. You know, we're really kind of new at all this mitigation stuff, and you're already saying it's not going to work. So establish your credentials for us first, and then tell us why you don't think it is enough.
I've been an environmental law expert or professor for 37 years, including 2 years as a Fulbright scholar abroad and many other visits to various places around the country and the world. Mm-hmm. And climate change is the ultimate environmental problem. Mm-hmm. It's not as if there's a gap between environmental law and climate change. So what I got interested in is why we weren't doing anything about it. And then after a while, I realized that what we were doing, some very feeble steps like the Kyoto Protocol, the biggest treaty on climate change, were everything was using the same approach, which is to spread out over several months and then several decades and attempt to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases. And I thought about that and decided that it couldn't possibly work in the real world. So my credentials are as one of the best-known environmental law scholars with a lot of publications and a diverse area of interest. I am or have been an expert in toxic substances, in air and water pollution, in endangered species protection, in hazardous wastes. And, you know, of all of them, I find that at the moment, climate change is the most fascinating, the most threatening, and the most global in scope.
We agree with that fascinating part. DR, thoughts before we go deeper?
Yes, Professor Lattin, you mentioned your background in environmental law, and I have to ask, in your view, how have the courts, particularly the courts in the United States, how have they responded in addressing this issue? What's your take on how well or how poorly they have done so? I bring this up because we have word today that the plaintiffs in the Kivalina versus ExxonMobil case,
I know what it is. They never had a chance.
Wow. And they're now appealing to the full Ninth Circuit in an attempt to have a rehearing of the case that they've lost.
I'll
at the
just repeat myself. They never have a chance or had a chance because what they're really asking is for the courts to create a new climate change program as well as to assess damages to particular corporations. That is ultimately a political and administrative function, and they're going to get tossed out. I mean, they can have as many appeals as they want, although in reality they can only have two appeals to the Ninth Circuit and the Supreme Court, and they have absolutely no chance of prevailing. Despite the fact that I, like many progressives, are sympathetic to their plight, the fact remains that the courts are going to say, if they give aid to these people, why not to everyone who's affected, the farmers in the Midwest who suffered from the worst drought since the Depression, people in California who've been getting one wildfire after another, the people in the Midwest, again, who've been getting hit by tornadoes. Why should the court pick one group of isolated people in Northwest Alaska and give them damages when people are being harmed by global climate change, even just if we limit it to the United States, all over the United States? It's just not going to happen.
I assume this also applies then to the Alec Lors case that's going on in the D.C. Circuit Courts as well. That's the lawsuit against Lisa Jackson, basically trying to get the courts to declare that the atmosphere is a public trust, and thus trying to sort of order the federal government to implement some sort of climate change policy.
I'm less familiar with that specific case, but what I can tell you is that no Supreme Court or appellate court is going to impose its judgment on which things are important and which aren't, and which people should be compensated and which shouldn't. How many jobs would be lost if we really turned the atmosphere into a public trust? And if we didn't do that, who would make the decision of which jobs and activities are consistent with the public trust and which are inconsistent? Who would make that judgment? If people are asking the courts to make that judgment all across the United States, that isn't going to happen. They're going to refer you to the regulatory agencies and Congress. Congress isn't doing anything, and they're suing the EPA, so the EPA has already decided to do rather feeble steps in regulating just new plants from a few big industries. And that's what the official policy in the United States is. So you have to ask yourself, what can a court do? And a court cannot substitute its own judgment for a nationwide plan, whether it's based on public trust, whether it's based on injured people who have to relocate, like in Kivalina. It's just not going to happen. And there are any number of environmentalists who would like the courts to intervene and say, well, since the executive and congressional branches aren't doing anything, then the courts will take over and do their responsibilities that they're not undertaking. But that, my friend, is not part of our legal system, and it's not going to happen.
Professor, you mentioned the word feeble, and I know you use that term to describe a lot of the government's attempts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But you say even more than that, that President Obama's proposal to reduce gas discharges by 17% in 2020 and by 83% by 2050 will actually make climate change steadily worse.
I think we should insert the word allow climate change to get steadily worse rather than make it. But with that one exception, I stand by that absolutely.
How so?
Well, the scheme that Obama, and he drew those figures directly from the Waxman-Markey bill in Congress, that scheme says each year we will cut down on a percentage of the greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide, that's being discharged. So he's saying by 2020, we'll reduce the annual amount of greenhouse gas discharges by 17%. That sounds like an achievement, but what's going to happen to the 83% that isn't reduced? The 83%, that's the other part of the 100% of greenhouse gases, the 83% is going to be discharged into the atmosphere, where it's going to combine with the existing amount of greenhouse gases already in the atmosphere, which is already too high. That's why we've been having all these terrible climate and weather conditions over the last few years. So for decades, he's going to allow more greenhouse gases to continue into the atmosphere, where they will combine with the existing high amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere to produce a higher concentration of greenhouse gases. And a higher concentration of greenhouse gases is exactly what will cause global climate change to keep getting worse.
Professor, you mentioned the Waxman-Markey bill, and at the time that it was taking place, there was a debate of sorts between, on the one hand, people such as Paul Krugman and Joe Rome, who were supportive of it, and people such as James Hansen, who felt that it would not do enough to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and supported a revenue-neutral carbon tax instead. In your view, would Waxman-Markey have been effective, or would a carbon tax been more effective in reducing climate change, or neither really truly going to get us to where we need to be?
Well, as I was just trying to explain, Waxman-Markey would have been totally ineffective. It's exactly the same numbers as Obama's plan, because Obama took them from Waxman-Markey. It wouldn't have been successful because it would have kept allowing high amounts of greenhouse gases to go into the atmosphere, combining with the existing amount to make things worse. As for a carbon tax, it depends on the specific characteristics of a carbon tax. I favor a carbon tax as part of a broader multi-institutional program that also includes direct regulations imposed on the worst greenhouse gas polluters. It also includes the National Academy of Sciences and Engineering choosing the best alternative clean technologies, and it also includes a national disclosure program. I don't think that one program alone can ever be successful, but of all the programs, I don't agree that a tax could be the leading program. That would take forever, because the richest companies in the country, and probably the world, are the fossil fuel companies, the producers of fossil fuels and the generators of fossil fuels. So how long could they pay the tax for? And the answer is a very long time. They've got trillions of dollars of assets. Unless you had a really high tax. And if you had a really high tax, that would create all kinds of social dislocation, as companies and institutions with lower funding, you know, ran afoul of the tax. Tax won't do any good unless you've got an alternative to offer. Otherwise, they'll just charge a lot of money. And the people who are in the best position to pay the tax are the worst greenhouse gas polluters.
Well, that's a good point. Well, you say that clean alternative technologies is really the key here to have a realistic approach to limiting increasing quantities of persistent greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. But are those clean alternative technologies here yet? And if you could go, you know, a little bit deeper on what those technologies are that you have in mind. Are they on a shelf? Have they yet to be conceived?
All right. My answer to that, obviously, that's not a 10-second. I can't give a 10-second answer to that, but
you have 10 minutes. Go ahead.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Then well, not my, just on my that one, but the interview.
My response to that is it won't be one technology. It'll be a mixture of technologies which are more or less suitable in different places. And most of those technologies are either developed and available, such as solar energy and wind power, or else they're in the process of being commercially developed. The example I use in my book is fusion, which is being promoted by a guy, Dr. Prager, who's the head of the Princeton Plasma Laboratory. And he makes the point that the fuel for fusion is deuterium and tritium, which can be separated out from the ocean at practically no cost. So fusion produces no pollution. It's uses almost free fuel, and it can be available to any country that is adjacent to the ocean. And it's already well down the path towards development in projects. I mean, he's run projects in it, but it will take a considerable amount of money to turn that into commercial scale development. And I think it can be done in 20 years, which is a lot shorter than the Obama and congressional timeframes when they're not doing much of anything except reducing emissions by a small amount.
Do you think a Romney administration would do more or less?
Less. Who's funding them? The Koch brothers and other people who benefit from continued fossil fuel things. It would cost the richest people in this country hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, if we stopped using fossil fuels, petroleum for automobiles, and if we started relying on a range of new technologies which they don't already have a lock on, the way they have a lock on fossil fuel production and energy generation. So they're going to oppose any real meaningful switch to alternatives. They're going to oppose that till their dying day, as it were. And it's going to take intense political lobbying and economic subsidies in order to use technologies that already exist. Do you know that oil, for example, is still getting a larger subsidy than solar power? Mm-hmm. Much larger?
Oh, yes. We talk about that all the time here.
Pardon me?
We talk about that on the show all the time, how it would be inequity.
So that's a reflection. You can call it an inequity. It's a reflection of political and economic power in our society, mm-hmm. and that's going to have to change or else there isn't going to be any solution. But I'm saying that the Obama reducing pollution a little over 40 years, that plan couldn't succeed even if we had the most progressive, liberal Congress in the world. It just can't work. And a carbon tax can't work by itself when the richest people who can pay the most tax are the enemy, as it were. They'll pay, but it won't lead to the reduction or significant reduction in greenhouse gases. So, you know, I don't like saying this since it's not something I'm good at, but basically we need to recognize that nothing's going to happen that will be very beneficial without a major political confrontation and movement.
Professor, you mentioned the issue of a carbon tax being problematic because the biggest polluters can simply pay it. I want to get your take on the fee and dividend proposal that Bill McKibben and Jim Hansen have supported, where a gradual.
I'm very familiar with Hansen's. I didn't realize that McKibben got on the bandwagon.
Yes.
All right. It's very simple. It's very simple. We tax people who are associated with fossil fuels and other greenhouse gases, and we give the money back to people in order so they feel that they're not being oppressed by yet another tax. Mm-hmm. That's why they call it a fee rather than a tax, but it is a tax. And here are the flaws. The first flaw is the one that I just mentioned, that the other side are the richest people in the country, in the world, so they can pay a lot more tax than typical consumers. The second problem is we're never going to be able to do it without a new technology that doesn't require fossil fuels and doesn't put out greenhouse gases. If we give all the money back to the people, where are these new technologies going to come from? Who's going to fund them?
The free market, you don't think we'll come up with it?
The free market, the ones that gave us the climate change to begin with?
Well, I think the idea is that through this you will create the incentive within the private energy industry to begin investment in those new
believe
technologies.
Believe me, I'm plenty aware of those ideas. I don't believe them. I don't believe them for a variety of reasons, but the biggest reason is that what is the number one incentive-making instrument in the market? It's called money. Mm. And who has the money? And it would take a very long time. One of the great dichotomies in Hansen's work or in his analysis is he's always talking about how urgent the situation is and how we have to stop doing things like coal within the next 10 years. What's the time frame for his fee and dividend project? I would say it would take at least 50 years, even if it could work at all, it would take at least 50 years to get anywhere, if not 100. Because he can only take a little fee. If he takes a major fee, then that will create social dislocation all around the country, with small businesses being driven out of business, with millions of jobs being lost, with a whole change in the economic architecture of the country. That is, if you charge a lot. If you charge a little, only a small fee, then obviously nothing will happen, or very little will happen. And if you change a large fee, the companies that are best able to sustain that fee are the polluters, the enemies, as it were. And many other companies would fall by the wayside, creating social dislocation havoc long before ExxonMobil goes out of business. So I don't think that he's really thought through the time frame in which his system would have to work, and also who's going to pay for the new developments and new technology, which we both believe is necessary if you give all the money back to the people. This is simply an attempt of Hansen, who's a great scientist and a courageous leader, but no economist. It's his attempt to placate other people by saying, look, you won't lose. We'll give all the money back to good people as long as they don't have more than two children, because he's splitting things evenly between families with up to two children. But at any rate, I've given you a number of different reasons for doubt at this point, and the biggest reasons are how wealth is distributed in the United States now. I'm sure you've talked about that plenty. And the consequences all around the country. If we did institute a tax scheme or a fee scheme that is high enough to really make a difference, his would not be high enough to really make a difference, not for many decades, if at all.
So I guess you feel that individual efforts or family efforts to go green and reduce their ecological footprint and gas emissions is really futile?
I do.
Or is that something
What I think what those people should be doing is joining political groups that are demanding better political responses. Instead of going green, you should be out trying to force your congressman to go green.
How do we do that? We're trying. We're not even having the conversation, really, you know, at the congressional level, politically, public, you know, people just don't seem to want to deal with it or even talk about it in the presidential debates.
Well, I agree on that, but all I could say is we need a new leader. I thought that Obama was really into it, but he and his advisors correctly assessed that there wasn't a desire on the part of most people. We're going to have to wait until there are a series of even greater disasters than the ones we experienced this summer, because without a political change that takes away the privileged position of the fossil fuel producers, I don't see how anyone could realistically expect that climate change would be remedied. Even if they have an idea like me of how to go about remedying it if we had adequate political support and adequate funding, which is to find the worst sources of greenhouse gas and replace them with clean technologies, even at a high cost initially, but a cost lower than what climate change is going to cost us.
We just have a couple minutes left. I wanted to ask what you think of AB 32, our landmark legislation here in California, which is really all about incremental mitigation. I imagine you don't think it's going to succeed based on what you said so far, but
correct.
Do we need programs like this to at least be started so we can see what happens?
No. AB 32, I'm sorry, my opinion is AB 32 is in the same branch as Waxman-Markey and Obama's proposals and Kerry Lieberman. It's planning on cutting a small amount each year without taking the, without resolving the question of what's going to happen when the remaining amount each year goes into the atmosphere and combines with what's already there. They're just thinking reduce this year, reduce next year. They're not thinking about all the greenhouse gas emissions they're not reducing, which are going to go into the atmosphere and combine with the greenhouse gases that are already there to keep making things worse.
So we're just shuffling chairs on the deck of the Titanic, as they say.
Well, that's one interesting image. I was just going to say that, yes, it's slightly better than absolutely nothing, but no, it is not good enough to have any real, genuine progress towards overcoming climate change, and it's just a colossal waste of time and money, just people running around doing things that will not result in a reasoned improvement. So, no, I don't approve of, you mentioned Paul Krugman. Normally I like him, but his take on the climate change problem was we have to do something now, even if it's imperfect. He was referring to the Waxman-Markey bill. Mm-hmm. It's 100% wrong. If we start going in the wrong direction, that will take money, that will take time, that will take personal efforts, all of it winding up being wasted and useless. So if we're going to go in the direction, we have to make darn sure we're heading in the direction that will really yield progress.
Are there others out there who agree with you?
AB 32 won't.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I just wondered if you have found others who feel the same way. I imagine they're out there. I just wondered if you've connected with them yet, whether they be authors or scientists or maybe a politician or two.
My response to that is any scientist or engineer who is pushing an alternative technology would agree with me because they want to develop their technologies and think that they could do a better job that way than just cutting back on emissions at the moment. As for policy analysts or professors or whatever, there are a few, but not many yet, and that's mainly because of my difficulty in getting the message across and people's reluctance to believe that the bad people or the people who are just in denial, they're happy that nothing's happened. It's just one more cost to them. And the people who care, the progressives, liberals, and environmentalists, they don't want to acknowledge that what they've been doing has not been useful. Mm-hmm. In fact, if anything, it's just been wasting time and money on solutions that solve nothing.
Okay, DR, I'm kind of depressed. How about you?
Before we let you go, I wanted to ask you, you'd mentioned, the Obama administration determining that the public willingness might not be there for strong climate action. What do you make of the recent polling, especially from Yale, I believe it's Yale Climate Change Communication, and also Stanford, indicating that there is, in fact, strong support for taking action on climate change? Do you think that's only up to a certain point, or what do you make of that?
My answer to that is I don't read the polls any better than you do. It seems like a cyclical process. People say, when people were polled, what is the most important environmental problem? Recently, the polls have shown air pollution and water pollution have been far above, and solid waste disposal, have been far above climate change in the hierarchy that people set. But on the other hand, now we have a different poll worded in a different way that elicits a lot of people saying we're concerned. If you designed a poll that said, look at the droughts, look at the wildfires, look at the floods, look at the heat, et cetera, then of course people will say that they are terribly concerned. But concerned at what, and concerned to do what? I'm sorry if I've been depressing to you, that, you know, and trying to be realistic from my perspective. Mm-hmm. But the reality is I'm giving away or identifying a way to actually achieve what people want to achieve. It wouldn't be easy, it wouldn't be cheap, but it would enable people to overcome climate change so much that the Earth's natural sinks would be able to absorb whatever was left, and we would actually have a solution. Do you really want to spend your time and effort pursuing solutions like Obama's plan, which simply cannot achieve any progress? No.
I certainly don't want to spend the rest of my career talking about things that aren't going to work. So, yeah, I get your point, and I appreciate your contribution to the body of knowledge that is out there.
Well, thank you very much.
It may not be a popular position, but it's important to get out.
Well, I wish I could contribute it more often to more people.
Well, we're doing our part here in getting you on.
Yes, you are.
And we appreciate your thoughts and your book, and I'll do my part to tell my friends in the environmental community to check it out. And parting thoughts, D.R.?
Yes, I do have a parting thought, which is I'd appreciate the opportunity to say that people should read my book in order to understand why what we're doing now hasn't worked at all, and that the book can be purchased either at my website, which is ecovitality.org. That's the word vitality with eco in front of it, .org, or at amazon.com. At Amazon, there were a few positive reviews by people who have read it and known critical. So all I could say is people aren't going to understand what I'm saying unless they actually read my book or summaries.
Sounds like a very interesting read.
Okay, thank you. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to hear a religious and spiritual perspective from Reverend Earl Cotin. Stay with us on The Green Front. We'll pick it up a little bit, dealing with a little dose of reality on this show, but we need to do that to move forward.